At odds with his father, Tom had left home as a boy, and now his parents were dead, he drifted like the twigs and leaves on the river.
I've never done anything like this before, so I don't know how I'll do at it, but I suppose reading things into a microphone, I should be able to do that.
And you got out of the car, pulled down the fly and pistol over the roses. This is on a Sunday afternoon. It's a beautiful summer Sunday afternoon. That was the end of that. Oh God, we just thought it was brilliant after that. Really.
This is Anne Enright's voice, all right. Wry, disabused, reckless, candid and funny. It's a huge pleasure to welcome to the stage Anne Enright.
You are listening to Red Line Readings, which was recorded live at Civic Theatre Tallaght as part of South Dublin Library's Red Line Book Festival's Reader's Day. On this programme, you will hear Dermot Bulger in conversation with Ferdia McKenna. In this programme, Dermot will also recite two of his own poems. We are joining Dermot at the Civic Theatre as he introduces Ferdia to the audience.
Over the past 10 years, I've tried to invite the cream of Irish writing to come here and to entertain you and to engage with you. And but I ran out of people, so I thought I'd ask a gouger. So, ladies and gentlemen, it's a huge pleasure to introduce Ferdia McKenna, who is a novelist, and it's his wonderful novel, which has just been reprinted in the series called Classic Irish Fictions, The Last of the High Kings, is one of my favourite books for anybody of my generation who grew up in the actual 70s. It is a brilliant recreation of 1970s childhood in Holt. And his book, The Rocky Years, the memory of his life as a rock star and as a somebody who became a closet member of Eamon de Valera's family, as Rocky de Valera, is a fascinating book. And Ferdia, to begin, would you read us an extract from The Rocky Years? And would you explain to us how, although you had wonderful parents, you could have had an even more interesting parent?
Yeah, I had some options. Yeah. My parents were very consistent throughout my life. They told me nothing but lies about everything. My dad was in the theatre, he was in the Abbey Theatre, and he passed last year. And my mum had been an actress, but once she married my dad, she used the rest of her time to act out the roles she should have played on stage in our home and anywhere else she found where she could find a stage in either Holt or whatever. So I remember I asked my parents once where I came from, and they said, well, you know, my mother said, you've Spanish blood, you know, a member of the Armada, a ship crashed on the coast of Roscommon. And, and the survivor made his way to a barn and met one of your ancestors. And that's so I believed this until I was 40. And then my father said, no, that's not true. That's just the story she made up to keep you entertained. So they made up a lot of stories, but one of the stories that was most interesting was how they met. And everybody kind of, well, I don't know if everyone does, but at one stage we were curious about how my mother met my father. And they told us a number of stories. And one of them stayed in my mind, and I believe this until probably just a few years ago. And there were other, then we heard the true story because my dad wrote an autobiography in Irish, and he put it in there. But this is the story of how my mum met my dad. And it's called Rock Hudson Could Have Been My Daddy. My father met my mother on the set of a Rock Hudson film called Captain Lightfoot, a swashbuckling adventure about Michael Mann, an 18th century Irish Robin Hood who gave the British a hard time in Ireland and America. The film was shot in 1954 in Ireland, and my dad had a small supporting role playing the British Army officer who arrested Lightfoot, played by Rock. In his big scene, Dad pointed a pistol at Rock and delivered the line, "Take this man to the captain." A framed colour still of this moment hung on the wall in the front room of our house in Holt when I was growing up. There was Dad looking stern in a red coat and a tall hat, while alongside him stood Rock Hudson, appearing unperturbed at being surrounded by bristling redcoats. Rock Hudson was disguised as a monk. My mother played an Irish rebel. Her big scene was shot at Bective Abbey, where she stood in the midst of a gathering of irate Irish insurrectionists. At one point, she raised her fist and yelled, "Up the rebels!" She doesn't appear in the film again. She always maintained there was a lot more to her role and a good deal more dialogue, but her scene had been dropped because of politics. Mother's Rebel hung on the wall next to Dad and Rock. Dressed in an Irish rebel costume of long skirt and a shawl, she looked wan and enigmatic as she posed in a doorway. My dad fell in love with my mother the instant he saw her on the set, and he told his friend he was going to marry her. Dad's friend told him he had no chance, but Dad's friend was wrong. Dad asked Mum for a date, and she said yes. At this point, Dad began to notice that Rock was taking an undue interest in my mother whenever she was on set. Rock called Mum Caroline. Mum called Rock Rock. When the movie wrapped, there was a big ceilidh for the cast and crew. Rock Hudson asked my mum to dance, so she taught him the Waltz of Limerick. They appeared to be having great fun, which made my father angry. He wasn't having this Hollywood star muscling in on his girl. At one stage, my father went eye to eye with Rock. Words were exchanged. For a brief moment, it looked as though my dad was going to burst Rock Hudson. But common sense prevailed, someone intervened, and there was no punch-up. Rock Hudson returned to Hollywood, where he enjoyed a successful movie career, unhindered by the fact that Captain Lightfoot was only a minor hit. In the 70s, it inspired Michael Cimino's Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. And a year later, the British Redcoat and the Irish Rebel got married. It was a pivotal time for my parents, and maybe for young Rock, too. For a brief moment back in 1954, had Rock considered abandoning his closet life as a gay man for a shot at heterosexual happiness with my mother? Could I have been the son of Rock? Thank you.
So how do you think Rock would have fitted into general life in Holt?
I'd say my mother would have loved him. She would have paraded him around, but she would have given him a hard time too. She gave everyone a hard time. There was a film made of Last of the High Kings, which was this book, which was my first novel. And in the film was shot in Holt, and my mother, having read the book, refused to have anything to do with the film or the book, and denied she was in the book, and denied that the character of the mother in the book had been modelled on her. But after the years waned, you know, I don't know if anyone's seen the film, but there's a very large portrait of a very over-the-top Irish mum in the film, played by Catherine O'Hara. But my father thought it was okay, but my mother wouldn't see it. But then years later, she rented the video, and she said, that film that they made of your book, Freddie, The Last of the High Kings, it was pretty good. But the woman who played the mother was fucking magnificent. So I presume that was a good review years later.
And I actually have a copy of The Last of the High Kings at home called 1977.
Yeah.
It's a manuscript copy of it.
Well.
I just can't sell it, you know. It's a brilliant description of that sort of world. It actually begins with, as memory serves right, one of your younger brothers coming down very steep driveway in a Dalek machine.
A Dalek, yeah.
Yeah, because your father would do pantomimes and do Christmas shows in the Abbey. Your father was artistic director of the Abbey Theatre.
He was, yeah. He would come home with occasional props, and one of the props was a Dalek from Doctor Who and the Daleks that a small boy could fit into. And it had wheels, which meant it could roll around. It was made in wood. It looked very impressive. But our driveway was steep. So we went out, and my brother Niall got into the Dalek, and I was supposed to hold him, but I got distracted. So the Dalek turned around and went down towards the road and went out in the roadway and bonded with the traffic for a while. So if you'd have been driving around Holt in 1977, you'd have seen a whole bunch of cars and a Dalek following them. And it took us a while, and then we had to get him out of the back. The back had jammed, and so people saw us grab a Dalek, push it over on its side, and prise open the back with a bar and pull a small boy out. And I suppose lots of people thought, oh, so that's how they did it in Doctor Who. They got small children to put them in. But our house was sort of... my dad was in the theatre. I thought everybody grew up, you know, with some kind of... a dad who had a ponytail and carried Beatles albums around under his arm and worked in the theatre and brought home odd-looking props like Daleks. But it wasn't to be. We had a driveway, and there were wooden gates in the driveway. And my dad drove a car, and there was kind of a steep incline in the driveway. And he used to stop the car at the bottom and open the gates and drive up and then go back and close the gates. And one time we were playing football in the yard in the front garden, and we heard this crunching sound, and all the bits of gate flew in the air. And my dad just drove up the driveway, got out of the car, slammed the door. He says, "Better open those feckin' gates." But he made us clean it up. So I mean, so it was an unusual house to grow up in.
You actually had a very theatrical childhood, but also you had a very Republican childhood because your mother worked for the cause.
My mother worked for the cause. My mother's idea of happiness was to get us all to go down to the Trinity College and rip the gates and turn them into pikes and march up north and push the Brits into the sea at the end of our pikes and everything would be fine then. And then we all speak Irish and we're Bonines. You know, I think she had a romantic, rose-tinted view of the Pierce Revolution, mm-hmm. and that was the kind of thing. I don't think she connected too well with it, but I think it was consistent in her life that she always did it. And then years afterwards, my sister, Doreena, found out that, in actual fact, you know, she was raving about, my mum has been spent a lifetime raving about the British Army and giving out about them, but her dad had been in the British Army for 3 years, and he'd been a radio operator somewhere or other. And we used to say to, my sister said to my mum, so, Mum, have you still got the uniform? And my mother said, what uniform? And Andrina said, the uniform of your dad, who was a British soldier for 3 years. And that would shut her up for a little while. But it's funny, she had that view. She's larger. I mean, she's still around and she's still larger than life. When I got married to Kate, my wife, who's American. We went to Boston to get married, and the only person in our family who could come to our wedding was my mum, who was the last person I wanted to come to my wedding. And she went on the plane and she was going through customs and I was going through customs and Kate went through her side and I went through this side. And Boston immigration, as anyone knows, is pretty tough. And I remember going through and then looking back and there was my mother and she was there with the customs or the passport guy and she was waving her arms in the air and she was making the big Abbey Theatre speech and she was doing... And I heard at one point, I am Caroline McAnna from the Abbey Theatre, you know. And so anyway, the guy turned to me and he says, is that your son? And I said, she said, yeah. And he called me, beckoned me over. And my mother, the problem was it was my mother's passport. She hadn't liked the photograph, so she'd torn it off and she stapled in one she did like. So he was saying, your mother's passport is illegal and we're going to deport her, you know, so we probably have to deport you as well. And meanwhile, all my in-laws, my to-be, who had never met me, were outside waiting. What's the problem? Oh, his mother's been arrested. So she said at one point, she said, look, she said, I wouldn't be in your country at all except my son is marrying one of your people. I just closed the passport, handed it to her, waved it to her, and said, tell your mother to get a new photograph. So I don't know if anything was ever normal, you know, in our house. It was kind of grown up like that. Everything was kind of epic and large. And when I wrote The High Kings, I was trying to capture a summer in 1977 where the sun shone, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You can always remember one of those summers in your life. So, so my mother was a dominant force in my life, and she became a dominant force in the book as well.
But there was also when I knew you first, it didn't seem certain that you would ever get to write the books that were inside you, because you had a very, very long, in fact, the first book you had published, Baldhead, captured the experience of being, life going swimmingly well and sort of meeting someone you loved and marrying and starting to, you know, ending a rock career and sort of moving into journalism and then suddenly being hit by a different type of thunderbolt than actually in the Rock Hudson film, a thunderbolt of discovering that you had testicular cancer.
Yeah.
And were there times when you felt, I'm never going to write these books, I'm never going to live the life that I want to lead?
It's funny, strange when you... Yeah, there was a time... I don't know if I thought like that. I was 30, and then suddenly... you know, a testicular cancer, which I'd never heard of. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly I went from having two testicles to one. Went mm-hmm. from stereo to mono, is the way I put it. Mm-hmm. One swoop of the surgeon's knife. And I kind of, I kind of saw it as, once I discovered the shock of it, once I heard the word tumor, and once I realized I was in a bit of a battle, it sort of, life became very simple. It was either black and white life or colorful life. You know, the black and white life was the seriously ill life. You were living in the cancer ward, and then the colorful life was the life outside that didn't know you were in the cancer ward. So I was lucky. I was caught at an early stage. I went through chemo and came out the other side. And I remember thinking that at one stage that life would be great if you had options. You know, once you had an option, once you could choose to do something, you were free. And I remember thinking that the choice I was going to make when I was sick was just to try and be as happy as I could and as positive as could to get through it. So I used music and reading and whatever, and I got through it all the way through. Of course, you know, I had to deal with my mother and father, so I tried to think, well, what's the best way to get through this without complications? And I didn't tell them. But of course, my father found out, and he told my mother, and my mother came to visit me in the hospital. And that was an epic experience. I was in the ward, and I had one of the drips wired up to, and I was kind of like wired to the bed, really. And in the door, I could hear down the corridor, "Where is he? Where is my son?" And I come in, comes in the door, and she looks, and she mistook a guy in the other bed for me. And the guy in the other bed was reading a book. He was bald-headed. He was going through the cancer thing, and he looked up, and there was this woman dressed in black looking at him, coming over towards him, calling his name, "Ferdia, Ferdia, Ferdia." And the poor man must have thought there was the angel of doom just going to take. And I remember he just closed the book and looked at her, and he would have done anything she said. And then I called, "Mother, I'm over here, I'm in the other bed." She turned around, came to the other bed, and for some reason kissed me and missed me and hit the bedpost, which is an unnerving thing to have. So I think if I can get through this visit with my mother, I can get through anything. It took three nurses to escort her to the lift. I could hear her voice all the way down. "I've never been treated like this before in my life." So it was, but it was an experience that it changed me hugely to go through that, and it was about a year of my life. And I can remember the thing about when I got better, or when you don't get better, you get 90% kind of all clear. I went back to work and I threw myself into it. And I thought I was immortal again, because when you're that age, you think you can do anything. You've just been in the band, or you've just been married, and you're going to write these books. You're going to do this thing. And I remember that I didn't realize my immune system was depressed, and that nearly finished me off. So I just collapsed and ended up back in hospital. And it was a doctor who was, he was very, he's very grumpy when things are going well, and incredibly happy when he thought you were doing badly. And he came in to see me, and he was incredibly beatific, big smile. "How are you? How's it going?" And I knew, oh God, I'm really in trouble now. And what had happened, I'd gone back to work too early. I picked up pneumonia and pleurisy and a few things, and that was more dangerous than the actual cancer. But it was something I. Actually, Dermot commissioned me to write about it. He said, I had a brain hemorrhage the year before that, which is another story. So I had brain hemorrhage and cancer. He says, "What age are you? 30? You've had a brain hemorrhage and cancer. You just need to marry. I don't know anyone else who's done that kind of thing. Why don't you write about it?" So I did, and it was published as Bald Head. And that helped me, and it got me a writing style. It meant that I knew where I was going to go with writing, because before that I had written loads of things that hadn't really connected, hadn't really made sense. But there's something about being seriously ill, or something about that experience which makes the world simple.
And does it strip away everything else? In the sense, strips away. These are things I want to do.
Yeah, it was very simple. It's very strange. Like, whatever makes you happy, I'll do. You know, it's not an odd thing to say. And whatever makes you feel bad, you avoid. It's an odd thing, but it tends to be that you divide the world into positive and negative, or at least I did. And I imagine things like, little visual things like Pac-Man, little Pac-Man machines eating up the cancer cells in my veins. And that made me feel good about stuff. And I was very lucky. It was caught in an early stage, and I responded well, and they hit me with it. Unfortunately, my beautiful hair never returned in its flowing form. But it did come back for a little while, and tufty bits came back. And I remember having to...
And you just said that your friends came up simply in a gesture of solidarity.
I had enough tufty bits, and I was kind of, thinking maybe I could shape these into a ponytail and I wouldn't feel so bald. And so I went to a very helpful barber, and I said, "Do you have any ideas I could maybe shape this into a ponytail? What would you advise?" And he said, "A transplant." So I accepted my baldness then. I tell people that I have hair, it's just invisible.
But the thing, to go back to The Last of the High Kings, which I think is one of the classic Irish books, how hard is it to write about... Obviously then you publish it and you say, this is not my family, but it's very obviously each member of your family and the different, because now time has moved on and the different struggles of sisters and brothers for freedom and everything else. But how hard was it to write about your family in this? I mean, did it need to be fictional in this way? Was this the only way that you could really get back into your childhood?
Well, I thought it was fiction when I wrote it.
Yeah.
But now that I look back on it, it really wasn't. I remember one person on my road had read the book and had actually seen the film and said to me, the portrait of your mother in the book and the film, why was it so understated? and my mother, she's much more larger in life than even than I could capture. I was trying to make sense of something. I was trying to make sense of that summer, or that moment when you go from being a boy to a man, or a child to an adult. I was trying to make sense of the summer before you know what you want to do. And in my head was the leaving cert. It was waiting for those results. It was waiting for that summer where you didn't have a summer job and all your friends were disappearing and taking choices. And you made the choice of whether you're going to do something or not do something. So I was trying to write about that. And I had written about it when I was 18, and it was terrible. But I kept the manuscript, which any budding writers, I would say, keep your stuff. There's something in it that will pay off later on. And I remember that I kept that about six or seven of the characters and three or four of the set piece thing scenes. Like, there's one scene in the book where my mother has a row with the neighbour, which he was always doing anyway. It was kind of a regular thing. Get up, cup of tea, go outside, abuse the neighbour. But she there was one particular neighbour that she didn't get on with, and there was a wall separating our houses. And my sisters used to walk on the wall and be ordered to get down by the neighbour, you know. And so that dispute ended up becoming a chapter in the book where it's actually...
It became an international incident. It became like one of the fault lines of Irish and British history.
Yeah, my mother declared war on the neighbour who happened to have an accent that could be interpreted as English, but it wasn't. But she did interpret it as English. So she accused him of being a spy and all the rest of it. But and that was just one of the milder things. But to really prove the point, to win the battle, she ordered us all up on the wall to walk proudly. And she got up on her high heels and she walked it as well. So, and that's in the film and it's in the book as well. So I remember writing that and it came very naturally to me. And it's she would do it now. She's 87, but she'd go back and she'd stand up on that wall and she'd have a reason for doing it. And to her, that was an epic struggle. That was the victory of Ireland over England over a garden wall.
But it's always a huge pleasure to talk to you, and it is if anybody who's lived through the actual 70s, this is a great book, and you'll never look at Holt or Dalek or Doctor Who, or Fernie McKenna in the same way again. But it's been a huge pleasure having you.
Thanks very much,
Fernie McKenna.
Thank you.
I was going to read two poems today. I was going to read one poem now, but I want to read this called While We Sleep. And my own father died this year, and he died last year, sorry. And he began to slowly slip away from us. And it's about the journey that all elderly people make. My father was, my grandfather was a compositor. My father used to be sent out to Brian Wexford to get a book. He had to get every Friday night to get a book to read. And he would actually have... he was told to knock on neighbours' doors and ask them for a good book. It couldn't be a bad book, it had to be a good book. My grandfather loved to read, and then he also loved to get the Observer. My father used to be sent down to get the Observer. He was the only person in Wexford who read the Observer every Sunday morning to the train station. And I visited my father on Tuesday, and he'd had a dream that he was a boy again in Wexford, going off to try and find a book. And this is slowly about a man slowly losing his mind and going back to the place that he understood best. And it's called While We Sleep. While we sleep, they are slipping beyond our reach. Our elderly parents, frail aunts, grandfathers. They are dressing themselves, opening doors in the night, venturing out in search of the first home they possessed. Padding across motorway intersections in slippers in the dark, shuffling past office centres, hulls of lit up office blocks. We may be scared, but they know where they are voyaging, amid their endless confusion as to whether it is night or day, amid the terror they feel as they sense their brains capsizing. They are walking back towards the reassurance of first memory, the bedrock which for decades got obscured by pressing concerns, preoccupied with the business of surviving the business of life. But now the clutter of middle years has been hacked away, reunited with themselves, unhurriedly, with vision unimpaired. They are shuffling their way back to the streets of their birth, skirting carriageways, concourses, each neon-lit underpass. They are any age, and yet they have grown beyond age. They have become absences in our lives, demanding our care, yet at the same time oblivious to us. We confuse them, disconnected from the landscape in which they are young. We see shrunken figures in dressing gowns on Zimmer frames, but they are children sent through a message, an errand of trust. How can my father be 92 as he walks through Wexford town, knocking on neighbours' doors, stopping cloth-capped strangers, sent out to seek the loan of a good book for my grandfather to read, a novel with sufficient heft and depth and intelligence to distract, a compositor sick of back-proofing racks of letterpress newsprint, who wants to lose himself in a journey through unfamiliar streets, a quiet man who will be led astray by old age into the county home, where he waited for the books he sent his young son to seek years before. Gentle grandfather, Republican typesetter, drinker on Ram Street. Your vigil is over at the barred windows of that Enniscotty asylum. Your son is coming with your treasured copy of The Observer that he dutifully collects from the Dublin train every Sunday morning, with a Canon Sheen novel, with H.G. Wells and Chesterton, with Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe and Patrick McGill. He got distracted from his errand during decades in ship's cabins, grieving his wife's death, becoming a connoisseur of loneliness. But now he emerges through the far side of such struggles. He has left his front door open, every light on deck aglow. He shuffles on a busted hip, clutching a vast armful of books, knowing only that somewhere between Wexford and Finglas, between the century of his birth and the one where he dies, he will encounter his own father, equally ancient, equally young. His father will be pleased with the books, the errand fulfilled. So while we fret for him adrift in such dangerous depths, unable to stir between tides of remembrance and despair, a part of him siphons free from the confused husk who phones moments after we leave his house to ask why nobody ever comes, the path that walks beyond our remit towards his dead father. Even if we could follow them, they would be too engrossed to care for the distractions of strangers like us who are not yet even born. We would be intruding on a father and a son strolling back from town to the Green Street Terrace that is the first and the last home they share. And because this was a book about grieving, I wanted to write about other people as well, and this was a story that I heard, funny, the children of two girls sitting in this bus wouldn't know the story, and I identified them in any way. And his poem is called Other People's Grief. 1950s Dublin. Two girls sit silently on an open-backed bus, winter coats draped over their laps, so that the conductor, sauntering downstairs to collect their fares, will not notice the tiny infant's coffin cautiously concealed on their knees, the wooden box their hands cradle with covert tenderness en route to Glasnevin Cemetery's unmarked angel's plot, the journey never revealed to future husbands or children, the journey they never dare refer to, even with each other, this ache that might have allowed daughters to decipher them, the unutterable weight of that small box carried to their debts.
You've been listening to Red Line Readings, a Curious broadcast production in partnership with SAT Dublin Libraries. Red Line Readings was part of SAT Dublin Library's Red Line Book Festival and was curated by writer Dermot Bulger. Red Line Readings was made with the support of Sound and Vision, a Broadcasting Authority of Ireland fund. On this programme, you heard Dermot in conversation with Ferdia McCanna, who read from his book The Rocky Year, and Dermot reciting two of his own poems from his poetry collection The Venice Suite. You can podcast this programme on SoutDublinLibraries.com and on CuriousBroadcast.com.